You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and science fiction and how the two influence each other, broadcasting from Seattle. Let me introduce my guest for the rest of the hour, Lawrence M. Krauss, who's a theoretical physicist at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He's also the author of many books, including the very famous The Physics of Star Trek and Adam, an Odyssey from the Big Bang to Life on Earth and Beyond. Welcome back to Science Friday, Lawrence.
It's always great to be here.
Octavia E. Butler is a writer whose works include The Parable of the Sower, Bloodchild, and Lilith's Brood. She has won the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award. She also received a MacArthur Fellowship in 1995. Welcome to Science Friday, Ms. Butler.
Thank you.
You're welcome. David Brin is an astronomer and writer who has also won both the Nebula and the Hugo Awards. His many books include the Life Eaters, The Postman, and the nonfiction book, The Transparent Society. Welcome to Science Friday.
Nice to be back,
Brin.
Guy, right?
You are listening to what Paul Allen was saying. Any reactions to Lawrence?
Well, I think I agree with a large part of it. I think science fiction can, in fact, inspire people to think about science. And in fact, what you said at the head of the hour, I think, is exactly right. That quantum teleportation is a fascinating aspect of science. But whether we'd be talking about it on the radio right now, if there wasn't Star Trek, is not at all clear to me. And so I think it's to the extent that science fiction can be used to inspire people to learn about the real universe, I think is very important. But it's also very important to know that there's a difference. Mm-hmm. Richard Feynman, I think, once said that science is imagination in a straitjacket. And it is. We're tied by reality. And it's important to know where science ends and science fiction begins, at least today. And the boundaries evolve. And I actually think that the real universe is one of the nice things about science fiction is if it can convince people to learn about the real universe, they'll learn that the real universe is, in fact, far stranger than anything that science fiction writers can come up with.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. Oh, you know, we hear news about this spooky action at a distance. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the words are interesting science fiction words. We have mysterious dark energy, dark matter. We have this expansion of the universe. It's almost like it's hard to do science fiction because it all sounds like science fiction. I mean, you know, how do you make science fiction anymore?
Yeah, I think that's that. Well, I think, you know, you try and be inspired. I think one of the reasons that there's a lot of connections between science and science fiction isn't necessarily causal so much as it's just creative people thinking about similar mm-hmm. problems. And it's not too surprising that sometimes they come up with very similar answers.
David Brin, are we being outpaced, science outpacing science fiction?
Well, there's constantly a tension there. The science fiction authors have to try to keep up to date. But the interesting thing is that only about a third of science fiction authors have any background in science or have any really deep interest in reading science. A lot of the stuff is very, very soft, near future explorations of little social results from, say, what if this little tweak or what if that little mm-hmm. tweak. But all of us have grown up reading history. Most of the science fiction authors I know, I happen to have a technical background. I was an astronomer. But most of the science fiction authors I know read history, a lot of it. And I've always believed that the genre should have been named speculative history because those stories set in the future are extending the human drama in thought experiments ahead to see possibly explore, not so much to predict, but to use those prefrontal lobes, those little nubs above our eyes that are what we use to think about the future, whether it's what will happen if I wear these clothes today, or what might it be like to ride a beam of light, as Einstein thought in his thought experiments. The most powerful form of science fiction is the self-preventing prophecy, not something that predicts the future, but something that prevents a future. The best examples being George Orwell's 1984, the movie Soylent Green that recruited millions of new environmentalists to help try to save the world, Dr. Strangelove, which might have helped us to prevent accidental nuclear war. The self-preventing prophecies are among the reasons why we're here talking right now.
Mm-hmm. Octavia Butler, you were inspired to start writing science fiction, I understand, by a movie called Devil Girl from Mars. Is that right?
It is. It's proof that even bad science fiction movies, can inspire things. I saw the movie, and I had been writing for a couple of years then. I was 12, And I had been writing for a couple of years, and I said to myself, geez, I can write a better story than that. And I think that gets a lot of people going writing science fiction, and it certainly got me going. The other thing that I did was go out and buy a book on astronomy so that I could find out something about Mars, which it's just possible that the screenwriter had not done.
a few flaws in the movie.
On the other hand, I didn't realize until then how much I enjoyed reading good popular science. And it's been a regular part of my reading diet ever since.
How would you define science fiction then? Is science fiction...
I think it's just fiction that uses science well.
I don't even think it has to use science well, actually. I think, in fact, I was once on a program with a well-known science fiction writer who said he thought the best science fiction didn't have a lot of science, but had a good story that could inspire people to think about those things.
I think there's always a lot of argument about what's science fiction and what isn't. My book, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, are actually one long book. Take a look at the future. They're kind of what David was just talking about, mm-hmm. In the hopes of preventing that future. They're not science fiction in the sense of using a lot of science, although it does come in. On the other hand, I think it's probably not inaccurate to call them science fiction.
Well, you have a book called Kindred, where you have a woman who goes back in time, but that's the only science fiction device?
That really isn't science fiction.
Right.
I needed the time travel device because I wanted to have this woman get acquainted with her past in a very personal way.
David Brin, does it bother you that you're classified as a science fiction writer then? Or
oh, not at all.
Welcome that.
Not at all. There are attempts by some people on some university campuses to sneer at this genre, but the ghetto walls that they've tried to erect around us have curved only around themselves. And it's really rather silly. In the past, when life was capricious and your children might die tomorrow, your happiness might dissolve instantly, but the kings were constant. The social order was constant, but life was capricious. All the tales that people told back then were fantastic. About 200 years ago, daily life became more predictable, but the social circumstances became capricious. Revolutions, changes, your children would not have the exact same beliefs that you had or use the same technology. And that's when a lot of people started telling us that the novel should focus on little tiny naval contemplations and so-called eternal human verities. I've always hated that term. I mean, if your children are going to be just as stupid as you and make the same mistakes, what's the point in having them? The implication of science fiction, and mind you, many, many science fiction stories are dystopias and warnings, and I highly approve of those. But the deep implication of science fiction is that your children might learn from your mistakes and invent new, interesting ones. And that brings us to the Science Fiction Museum, because here there are several rooms. There's the homeworld room. There's the room of possible human futures, and where that explores the choices that we face and the mistakes that we might make and the possible terrible outcomes, with the glimmering of possibility that if we make a few enough mistakes, we might get a good future for our children. There's the them room, which talks about the alien, and I think very thoughtfully includes not only the alien that we might meet out of the stars, but the aliens we might create. They say that every generation is invaded by a new wave of alien barbarians, its children. And then there's Fantastic Voyages, the room that Paul Allen dwelled on about spaceships, some fantastic new high-tech imagery. But there's always, the thing that has pleased us authors most is that there's this thread of literary thought that sort of, you know, thin but always there alongside all the movie images.
But the other thing that Paul mentioned that I think is important, and the museum actually heralds this too, is that science fiction has its base in popular culture really strongly. It began pulp magazines, and you know, one shouldn't discount that it sort of has a, it never initially intended to be highbrow. The issues end up being often profound ones, but it evolved from a real popular culture.
I think that depends on where you're looking. If you're looking in this country, you're right. But if you go back to Jules Verne or to H.G. Wells, I think they kind of began in literature, and then we kind of brought the level of literature down a bit, and have been trying to get it back ever since. A lot of us really resent things like not being reviewed in over 9 lines in a lot of book reviews, and we would like our work to be taken individually and judged, as opposed to being judged as science fiction. Oh, you know that kid stuff.
Let me see if I can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Richard in Miami. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hi, right, go ahead. Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to jump in and say I really burdened me with that. I'd like, instead of the idea of what to watch out for, that I think that science fiction implants with us the idea to accept things that are unbelievable that can be commonplace. To give you an example, my career is in computer technology, obviously, and the package that I've been working on for years and the stuff that I have my patents in is in speech recognition. And I always said at IBM that it goes back to, as a kid growing up, talking, you know, watching in Star Trek, them talking to the computer, and stories such as Colossus Project. And then my first software, the way you talk to the computer, was say computer.
Were you influenced by watching those Star Trek episodes and saying, I could build that?
Yes. I always grew up because it made it, I think, in our culture that it was an idea. As Clark says, that science fiction is just science fact we haven't done.
Let me get a comment from... Lawrence, you want to comment?
Well, I think there's some real that. I think there's a lot of science fiction is science fact that will never be science fact, and one has to be careful about that. I think it certainly inspires people to think about what they might do. And the neatest part about it is it inspires people to realize that things they're interested in are actually science. When you go up to people, if I go up to someone at a party and say I'm a physicist, they usually say, "How about those Indians?" I'm from Cleveland. But if then you say, well, you're interested in black holes or time travel or warp drive or one of those things, then people are interested. And so I think it gets people to realize that they really are interested in scientific issues, even if they don't know they are.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go into the audience here. Yes.
All of you on the panel are people who think a lot about how science engages the popular imagination. And I'm wondering if you could tell us why you think George Bush's proposed mission to Mars so failed to engage the popular imagination.
That was a lead balloon, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Well, I think I wrote about it. Actually, I was pleased to see that I actually wrote disagreeing with George Bush before he actually talked, which is the first time we've disagreed. I've sort of anticipated time travel there. But I think that the question is, the timing might have been bad. We came out at a time when these amazing rovers were on Mars. And all of us were on Mars. Anyone who had a computer could go to the NASA site and see real-time pictures of being on Mars. And as I said at the time, for me, I'd be just as excited, in fact, more excited perhaps, but just as excited if the first evidence for any extraterrestrial life, microbes on Mars, came from one of those rovers. I don't need to send a human being up there. And I think it came at a time when there are so many other fiscal demands that it's not clear to people that... this was the appropriate time to imagine sending humans to Mars, in my opinion.
We're talking this hour about science and science fiction on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Broadcasting today from the Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame, that's opening today in Seattle with David Brin, Octavia Butler, and Lawrence Krauss about science and science fiction. Why is so much... I was trying to think of science fiction movies, films, and... apart from, I think, Close Encounters, they're all just so negative. You know, they're battles against things and fighting off stuff. Except for, Close Encounters, where you actually have two civilizations coming together to exchange some positive something or other.
Well, actually, I think the reason Star Trek was so popular for all those years and is that it is a hopeful view of the future mm-hmm. and the whole. It's For me, the one of the most unrealistic things about Star Trek is everyone is an expert in science on the ship. But it's a view where science can actually make the world a better place because the Federation has already become a better place.
But you always have Captain Kirk duking it out in the back lot with somebody.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And winning, though.
A lot more interesting to look at, really, for people who maybe we're, you know, just tuned off from a mystery or a Western or something. It's really just storytelling. On the other hand, it's a great way to seduce people into maybe thinking about something more.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to remember that speaking as a story crafter, your job is to put likable heroes in danger, dire jeopardy for 90 minutes of a film or 60 minutes of a TV show or 600 pages of a book. It's harder to do that in a skilled and decent civilization. So it's no wonder that most of the people who are trying to tell a heart-thumping story assume that civilization is rotten. That makes the story just sort of roll right along. I call it the idiot plot. And people should watch it for it in their movies. Civilization never works, and all the fellow citizens are sheep. And we should chide ourselves for expecting that and believing
it
ourselves.
That's extreme, really. It's not that it never works. It's just that there are problems.
Well, yes.
And even in real life, there are problems, big ones.
And if you can focus on the problems, that's what Star Trek does. It focuses on a particular problem in a context of a civilization that works. Now, earlier I spoke in praise of some of these, the really well-written ones, some of these critical stories, because they are the self-preventing prophecies that point out problems so that we can fix them. A lot of environmentalist movies, the China Syndrome, the Hot Zone, these were all movies that stirred people to care about a particular public issue.
Do you think The Day After Tomorrow is going to do that?
Oh, yes, I think The Day After Tomorrow is going to stir a lot of interest, as my novel Earth did some years ago, about the implications of global warming, that sort of thing.
Don't you worry that it's so extreme that it's liable to not stir the right emotions, more like, oh, God, that's crap, maybe global warming is crap?
Oh, I think people are capable of recognizing exaggeration as exaggeration.
But the problem is, I kind of agree with Octavia, that what I worry is that the people will try to use that and say, well, that's exaggeration, but so is the hard scientific evidence for global warming, and try and make that connection. And in fact, that is the worry about some of this dark side of science fiction for me, is that it gives the impression that science is dangerous and evil, and it's not. We live in a better world in many ways, and most people in the world, I believe, are better off because of science in the long run. And we shouldn't give people the idea that scientists are the bad guys, because they're not.
Let me hold that thought, because we have to break away, and I want to get your whole thought in rather than rudely interrupting like I do every week. So stay with us. We'll come back with David DeBrin, Octavia Butler, and Lawrence Krauss, and your questions in the audience here and on the phone, so don't go away. We'll be right back from Seattle. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the intersection of science and science fiction with my guest, Lawrence Krauss, a theoretical physicist at Case Western Reserve University. He's author of The Physics of Star Trek, Octavia Butler, a writer whose works include The Parable of the Sower and Lilith Brood, David Brin, a scientist and science fiction writer whose works include The Transparent Society and The Postman. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the audience and your calls for some questions. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering if the panel realizes they were sitting next to the incarnation of Delos D. Harriman, the Robert Heinlein character from The Man Who Sold the Moon, and what they feel about that.
You want to explain that to our people who haven't read the book?
Robert Heinlein was a science fiction author who developed this timeline called the future history, and Delos D. Harriman was one of the main characters in many of his short stories.
Mm-hmm. David?
Yeah, let me explain. The Man Who Sold the Moon is about a private venture to go to the moon in a time when we really didn't quite know how difficult it would be. And so he uses every trick in the book to get investors to invest in a rocket voyage that gets to the moon. And of course the reference was to Paul Allen, the former founder of Microsoft, who has funded not only the Science Fiction Museum, but on Monday the first attempt to create a private astronaut launching out of the atmosphere. And of course, such comparisons, you know, between science fiction and reality don't only apply to science and to historical events, but they can apply to people as well. Mm-hmm. Why not? Well,
but Paul was the first, I think, to point out that and when you asked him, that private enterprise is not going to be sending people to the moon or Mars, certainly in the near term. It's just incredibly expensive to send human beings into space, and certainly on long missions. And I think the role of private enterprise in terms of increasing the possibilities for near-term space travel for people is one thing, but the incredible costs of going to the moon or Mars are the kind of things that are going to eventually require world resources, much less one single government resource, I think.
Yeah, I want to set this in the context of a movie we've all seen, 2001: A Space Odyssey. When that movie came out in 1967, there were two things portrayed. One was the promise of really, really high-tech technology. We'd all be going to space hotels, to Strauss waltzes in orbit. And that stuff has proved to be harder than we thought. It turns out the Earth is a deep gravity well, and its space is hard. It also portrayed a kind of nasty future human civilization, very sexist, racist, very secretive, extremely secretive, and patronizing toward the people. And one of the things I've been trying to point out lately is space has turned out to be harder than we expected. And we never give ourselves credit for the science fictional degree to which we've reevaluated some of the old social assumptions that we used to have. We're much more environmentally sensitive now. We've pushed back racism and sexism and some of these horrible things to a much greater degree than the cynics of those days might have expected. And with Octavia stoking the fires and keeping the pressure on us, I have a feeling we're going to keep at this. So who would have thunk that fixing our souls, our hearts, would turn out to be a little easier than getting to Mars?
Well, I think there'd be a lot of people would argue that it's not so clear, that when you talked about a lot of the aspects of 2001, about secretive a lot of people would argue that those problems exist right now in Washington.
Okay, let me get out of the politics well we're in and move on to the phones. Let me go to James in Philadelphia. Hi, James. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Let me say that I've read both Dr. Brind and Octavia Butler's books. I'm a 37-year-old old, and I've been reading science fiction literature. I'm mainly a science fiction literature reader since I was maybe like 9 or 10 years old. And I read all types, from the hard sciences to the more social, philosophical science fiction that deal with people problems. And that's the science fiction that I tend to like, and that's why I'm such a big admirer of Octavia Butler's. The first novel that I ever read of yours, Miss Butler, was Kindred, which I enjoyed richly. Because I tend to read science fiction that deals with people problems, with philosophical problems between people and what happens when societies break down, like your novel, Parable of the Sword, and I think your other novel, Clay's Ark. I just want to tell you how much I'm a big, big, big fan of yours, and I wasn't able to see you when you were here in Philadelphia for the Writers Conference a while back, but I just wanted to call you up and tell you what a big fan I am of yours, and I think that you're one of the most important science fiction writers of the 20th century, or going into the 21st century. And I've also read your book, Earth, Dr. Brind. I think you're of the hard science fiction writers. I think you're one of the best of them. And I just wanted to call up and say there are still lots of us out here reading science fiction literature. And I agree with somebody who said that science fiction literature shouldn't be just treated as some sort of kid stuff. It can be very, 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 very important.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Octavia was smiling when you said all those wonderful things.
Sure. But I also wanted to point out that all science fiction is essentially about people, no matter what else it's doing. It's something that we kind of forget about when we read hard science fiction sometimes, but if the people weren't in there and if they weren't interesting, I don't think we'd be reading the book.
Yeah, it's got to have a good story. I mean, that's the operative word in science fiction is fiction. And if it isn't compelling fiction, it isn't good whether the science is good or not.
But you mentioned kids, and I should plug what the Science Fiction Museum here in Seattle is doing. It's not only a museum of artifacts, but it's also trying to develop a very, very dedicated educational outreach program. Seattle hero Greg Bear and I and a number of other people in the science fiction community have been involved in trying to get outreach to teachers and librarians and kids to try to develop science fictional curricula that would help teachers teach almost any difficult subject can be illustrated by some science fiction story or another, not just in science and math, but in humanities. They're wonderful stories that can help a teacher to lift the class over a difficult point in curriculum.
And what we found is a lot of teachers are already using it anyway. I mean, a lot independently around the country, you find a lot of teachers using science fiction.
And the Science Fiction Museum is going to be trying to collate these efforts, trying to organize them, trying to put them together, and to get busloads of kids into the museum, because it's going to be a very inspiring place. There will be curricula that associate with every exhibit.
Gentleman on here in the right.
Yes, earlier in the show, it was pointed out that not only is Paul Allen supporting the Science Fiction Museum, but also the efforts to, in fact, find the real extraterrestrials with the construction of this new radio telescope, the Allen Telescope Array in California. By the year 2025, that thing will have been able to scrutinize several million nearby star systems, so there's some reasonable chance that it may have turned up real extraterrestrials. And I'm just sort of interested in what the panel, which is expert in projecting what life out there might be like, thinks that those detected aliens, assuming that we make that detection, might be like. Are they going to be these sort of little gray guys with no hair, big eyes, and no sense of humor that we see all the time on television, or will it be something a little more imaginative?
Well, I think if we, you know that I think it's a great project. It's a long shot, but if it, and so I wouldn't hold my breath. But if we discover extraterrestrial life, I'm convinced of one thing, and that all my experience as a scientist has told me that the universe surprises you every time you open a new window, and I'm convinced that that whatever we find out there will involve things that are totally unexpected and don't exist in the science fiction literature yet.
I thought you were going to say whatever it is, it's going to root for the Indians, but I wasn't sure.
Well, that goes without saying.
Octavia,
I think it doesn't matter as much what they're like as the effect that they're going to have on us. I think it really it will change the way we see ourselves in the universe. It's like the universe or God or whatever you choose to call it has other children, and all of a sudden there is this, whether it's a sibling rivalry or whatever it is, I think we are on a whole different footing. And some people have written about this kind of thing, how it affects religion, how it affects our military attitudes. Probably we will never see such other people, such aliens, but I think even without having seen them, without their having been there yet, as far as we're concerned, they've had quite an effect on us.
We're talking about science fiction this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me go to call in and see if we can get another call in from someone here in the audience. Hi, Eric in Indianapolis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was just wondering if the panelists, if they were stranded on a desert island and had to pick one science fiction book to take with them, what they would take. I know I'd take Dan Simmons' first Hyperion book, the first two, but I was wondering what the panelists would take with them.
And it goes without saying you would say that it can't be a book of their own, right?
It might be more interesting if it weren't a book of their own.
Well, I'd pick a very, very, very long one, so it'd probably be that I haven't read yet. So it'd probably be Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon. That one would probably sink the boat, though, that I was on. but I haven't read it yet, but I hear it's absolutely fantastic.
I don't think I'd be adventurous enough to take one that I hadn't read yet. I'd probably take an old friend like Frank Herbert's Dune.
That's a good one. Yeah.
I'd go for something I hadn't read yet. And I've talked about it, but I've actually never read that one of the early scientists, Johannes Kepler, wrote a science fiction story about going to the moon, and I've always wanted to read it, so maybe that was the opportunity.
You always plug astronomy, I swear.
You can't understand it. All right, Eric? You got your summer reading lined up. Thanks
Indeed.
For calling. Let me go to the audience here for the last question.
Hello. I read a lot of science fiction and science fact, and science fact just blows my mind repeatedly these days. Spooky action at a distance, teleportation, oh my goodness. Well, I'd like to hear from you guys, what's the coolest science fact thing you've heard lately that has your mind thinking about science fiction and what I could do with that?
30 seconds, Laura.
Well, I think for me the weirdest thing in the universe is the dark energy, the fact that the dominant energy in the universe is an empty space. And it's going to change our picture of the entire future of the universe, the future of civilization and what we'll know. And we don't understand anything about it, which for me as a scientist is the most exciting thing.
And that's between the dark energy and the dark matter, 96% of the universe?
Yeah, everything we see. And all the subjects of science fiction, for the most part, make up 1% of the universe.
Wow. David?
I would choose animal intelligence. A lot of my science fiction deals with that, uplifting of other creatures, and we're finding out, for instance, that bird brains aren't the insult that we thought they were. Pound per pound, they're smarter than we are. And who'd have thunk when I was a kid that we would find out that dinosaurs aren't related to reptiles at all. The second closest cousins are mammals, and their descendants are birds. The dinosaurs are with us flying in the sky. That sort of thing is so exciting, and we're discovering all that sort of thing all the time. But finding out how human intelligence works and plumbing the bases of morality, I think, is very exciting.
I think being at the beginning of being able to do genetic engineering is probably the sexiest thing out there right now. It's the scariest because we can make changes, and if we want to do it in a certain way, we can make permanent changes. And we probably will, and we won't necessarily know what we're doing in the long term, what effects we'll have on ourselves and other creatures on this earth. So I think biology, almost anything being done in biology right now, is really fascinating.
And I agree in one particular sense that's really useful for science fiction and science, and that is that this stuff's going to happen, whether we like it or not. And one of the good aspects of science fiction is that it causes people to think about it in advance.
And argue about it in the open, because that's the one. Human beings have proved that as individuals, they're not very wise. But if we criticize each other and make enough noise, we'll find most of the mistakes before they get too bad. At least that's the theory this rambunctious culture operates on. And this rambunctious culture is the culture that really pushed and developed and engendered science fiction in a museum like this.
Well, thank you all for joining me this hour. David Brin is an astronomer and a writer whose works include The Life Eaters Killed People on the Transparent Society. Octavia Butler, whose works include The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents and Lilith's Brood. And Lawrence Krauss, a theoretical physicist at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, author of The Physics of Star Trek, Adam, an Odyssey from the Big Bang to Life on Earth and Beyond. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us today. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Eric Altman, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer. And thanks also to Brendan Banizak and Anna Vigren in Washington. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. If you missed any of the references we make today, Charles puts them up there on our website. Surf over to sciencefriday.com. Also, you can get back editions of Science Friday to play, listen on Real Audio, or to download on your audible.com player. Also, we have Science Friday's Kids Connection. We make curricula out of our stuff, and we'll be going on hiatus a little bit for the summer, but you can still get back editions of the curricula we use on Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato in Seattle.